Next presenter is Giovanni Arrighi, teaches at Johns Hopkins University. Giovanni is one of our leading analysts in the world capitalist system. Massive work over 20, 30 years on these issues. I just mentioned his classic work, The Long 20th Century, Money, Power, and the Origins of Our Times, which came out in 1994. His new book, The Resurgence of East Asia, 500, 150, and 50-year perspectives, is coming out from Routledge, August 2003. He wrote with Beverly Silver, Chaos and Governance in the Modern World System, just before that. I was advised that in the interest of full disclosure, I have to mention that he has written an extensive critique of my own work, which just came out in the New Left Review. It's very interesting, of course, highly flawed. So, Giovanni.
Thanks. Can you send me a note when I've got 10 minutes left?
Sure.
I, at the risk of some self-indulgence, I'd like to start by reading the three closing paragraphs of the Long 20th Century, because they are the kind of conclusions that have been helping me monitoring what has been happening since the three paragraphs were written 10 years ago. And they also define what I understand by the new imperialism, if you have such a thing. So basically the book, I'm not going to say much about that book, but it was sort of identifying a cyclical pattern whereby long periods of financial expansions were always periods of hegemonic crisis and transition to something, to a new kind of organizations of world capitalism. But the whole point of identifying these cyclical patterns was not, as some critics have said, to uphold the view of nothing changes and everything stays the same, but on the contrary, precisely to identify what was new. And what I found that was new in the present situation was a fundamental bifurcation or fission between guns and money, that as capital was accumulating in its money form more and more in the East Asian region, contrary to previous transitions, the declining hegemonic power remained and consolidated its position as the overwhelming global military power. So guns accumulated at the pole of the old hegemonic center. And that was new, and would have prevented, in my view, the old pattern of transition to new hegemonic powers to occur, and that the system itself, as it had been unfolding and evolving over the preceding 500 years, was about to be superseded by something else. And these three closing paragraphs were pointing to what the three possible scenarios were, and now I'm going to read them. First, the old centers may succeed in halting the course of capitalist history. The course of capitalist history over the last 500 years has been a succession of financial expansions during which there occurred a change of guard at the commanding heights of the capitalist world economy. This outcome is also present at the level of tendency in the current financial expansion. But this tendency is countered by the very extent of the state and war-making capabilities of the old guard, which may well be in a position to appropriate through force, cunning, or persuasion the surplus capital that accumulates in the new centers and thereby terminate capitalist history through the formation of a truly global world empire. That was the first scenario. Second, the old guard may fail to stop the course of capitalist history, and East Asian capital may come to occupy a commanding position in systemic processes of capital accumulation. Capitalist history would then continue, but under conditions that depart radically from what they have been since the formation of the modern interstate system. The new guard at the commanding heights of the capitalist world economy would lack the state and war-making capabilities that historically have been associated with the enlarged reproduction of a capitalist layer on top of the market layer of the world economy. If Adam Smith and Fernand Braudel were right in their contentions that capitalism would not survive such a dissociation, then capitalist history would not be brought to an end by the conscious actions of a particular agency as in the first outcome, but it would come to an end as a result of the unintended consequences of processes of world market formation. Capitalism, the anti-market, as Braudel called it, and I agree with him in that, could wither away with the state power that has made its fortunes in the modern era, and the underlying layer of the market economy would revert to some kind of anarchic order. That was the second scenario. Finally, to paraphrase Schumpeter, before humanity chokes or basks in the dungeon or paradise of a post-capitalist world empire or a post-capitalist world market society, it may well burn up in the horrors or glories of the escalating violence that has accompanied the liquidation of the Cold War world order. In this case, capitalist history would also come to an end, but by reverting permanently to the systemic chaos from which it began 600 years ago, and which has been reproduced on an ever-increasing scale with each transition. Whether this would mean the end just of capitalist history or of all human history, it is impossible to tell. 10 years later, and by the standards of the book, I mean 10 years is not even, doesn't even make it as a short run. Where are we in this kind of possible scenario? Well, lots of things have been clarified, but basically we are still, the three scenarios are still possibilities. The history of the last 10 years has clarified many things. All three possibilities remain open in my view, and but what I'm interested now is to focus more specifically on the first scenario, because it's the one that would involve the imperialism in our times, in our epoch, which is the theme of this panel. So, from this point of view, you know, there are many things that actually happened and in some ways do not quite fit into what my expectations were. I thought that at the time that the only way in which a truly global world empire could be created was through multinational, multilateral institutions. I thought that what were you know, at the time I was after the first Gulf War, when the Bush administration had mobilized the UN in the enterprise, and there was a whole sort of set of institutions that were being involved. I thought that the only realistic hope for the United States and its closest allies to freeze history, end history, to end history, was to form as close as an alliance as possible and to bolster the institutions that were created after the Second World War as part of the U.S. Cold War order. What has happened, of course, as we all know, is that already under Clinton there was the discarding of the United Nations in favor of NATO, and then under the Bush administration a further step has been taken of discarding NATO in the favor of the 51 states of the new United States and go alone, basically. I've never counted Italy. And in fact, even in the coalition, they had enough sense not to involve Italy in the war. But besides that, what therefore is puzzling to me is how come that you know, it is going alone, because at one level it's totally unrealistic to try to create this global, this first in world history, a global empire. Why going alone? And there I think that I don't really have the answers to this, but so what I want to do with the rest of my time is really suggest more kind of directions in which to look, in which I'm planning to look, and others should look. The first thing is it's actually interesting that 2 weeks ago in the Sunday Times, in the Weekend Review, there was a piece by Neil Ferguson on the cost of empire that was basically restating the same thesis I had in the long 20th century, but now with 10 years of further sort of consolidation of this fission of money versus power. And I'm quoting now from that article where he says, in Britain's case, hegemony was also hegemony. Britons, the world's banker before 1914, never had to worry about a run on the pound during its imperial heyday. But today, as America throws rogue regimes, first in Afghanistan and now in Iraq, it is the world's biggest debtor. Actually, it is the biggest debtor in world history. I mean, it's never been as big a debtor in relative terms as the U.S. is today. Foreign investors now have claims on the United States amounting to about $8 trillion of its financial assets. That's the result of an ever larger American balance of payments deficits. This is not trade deficits. These are current account deficits, totaling nearly $3 trillion since 1982. Last year, the deficit was about 5% of gross national product. That's more than the U.S. Spends in military. The military expenditures of the U.S. are far less than that. So the U.S. military expenditures are entirely financed by foreign capital, if you want to put it that way, or half U.S. investment in or more in manufacturing. Anyway, this year it will be larger still. Foreign investors right now seem to be content with the prospect of a third year of disappointing returns on Wall Street and the lowest yields in Treasury bonds since 1962. But will they stay content? Another crisis of confidence is not impossible to imagine. Thus, President Bush's vision of a world recast by military force to suit American tests as a piquant corollary. The military effort involved will be unwillingly financed by the Europeans, including the much-reviled French and the Japanese. He has forgotten the Chinese are financing a growing proportion of this, even more than the French or the Germans. Does that not give them, Chinese, I mean Greater China, does that not give them just a little leverage over American policy on the principle that he who pays the piper calls the tune? Question mark. Here we have, in fact, a fundamental sort of contradiction that, in my view, is the driving force in the recent past and future military adventures of the United States. There is a problem if my scenario one as one of the ongoing projects is actually accurate. You have a problem which is the fundamental problem. Oil and all the other things are secondary issues related to this central problem, which is the stark choice facing the United States, and not just United States, U.S. capital, U.S. society included, is face a major downsizing relative, certainly relative, but possibly also absolute, of the U.S. economy to balance its accounts. And this can happen in many different ways, including could be a massive devaluation, it could be all kind of ways it can happen, but this is one possibility. Facing a major downsizing, which means that one of the most important levers of U.S. power in the world, in world society, in the world system, would be undermined, and this major lever is, of course, the fact that the U.S. economy is by far the largest economy in the world, and is seen as an essential driving force of the global economy itself. And of course, this is one, as Ferguson himself points out, this is one of the strengths of the United States, that no one, neither the Chinese, nor the Japanese, nor the Europeans, no one has really an interest in seeing the U.S. sinking, particularly sinking too fast. Mm-hmm. And Ferguson cites the famous saying of Balzac that, if you are a small debtor is your problem. If you are a big debtor, then is the creditor's problem. and this, of course, is one of the big issues when we talk about power relations, particularly in international relations, that it's measurement issues, or how you actually measure power relations. It's a very tricky and, to my knowledge, unsolved problem. And it's also one of the problems that arise when there is a mistaking of one's enemy's or one's adversary's weakness for one's own strength. This, in my view, is what did the USSR in, that they mistook the U.S. weakness of the 70s for their own strength and went into Afghanistan and did all kind of other stupid things, and eventually collapsed. And I think that, as I've been telling my friend Perry for a long time, this is what eventually is going to happen to the United States, that mistaking their enemy's weakness for their strength, they're going eventually to do themselves in. But the issue is really, if we think in terms that we are moving towards a process of world state formation, how do we conceptualize this process? I think that the old theories of imperialism, I've been saying this for 30 years, are totally inadequate to understand what was going on. The inter-imperialist rivalry, all that stuff is just, in my view, totally useless in understanding the processes at work now. But how do we conceptualize the formation, which also has nothing to do with Kautsky? I mean, don't raise Kautsky or go mad. How is the world state going to be formed? And here we are talking about the world state. How is the United States going to turn what has been a market-driven market, let's forget, to some extent, a market-driven balancing of its account into a tribute, into sheer tribute? That's what would be the global empire. The center, the old center, the United States, with its military and its military power, extracts tribute from the rest of the world. I mean, we have seen already that in the first Gulf War. The first Gulf War, the U.S. actually made a small profit. I mean, it was entirely paid by Germany, Japan, and Saudi Arabia, which in the process went bankrupt. So the problem is, how is all this process institutionalized? And I think I just have a suggestion. The suggestion has to do with a famous article by Charles Tilly. In fact, the racket has already been raised. But probably many of you remember Charles Tilly's article in 1985 called War Making and State Making as Organized Crime. Except that the whole article by Tilly, and then also which he developed later in the book Coercion and Capital in different ways, but the whole article by Tilly had to do with the formation of national states. It was entirely focused on that, and was exclusively valid to the extent it was valid as an analytical framework for analyzing the formation of national states. What we should try to be doing is now recast that analytical or reformulate the analytical framework for a world state, for the formation of a world state. Where, of course, when that is the process, war making and state making becomes, the distinction itself becomes blurry. And I'm just going to give a few quotes from both from Tilly, from Tilly's piece, and then, you know, it might be useful to reflect on how they can be applied. But once you think in those terms, then a lot of the things that seem crazy, of the United States going alone and all these things that I was mentioning earlier, then they make more sense, or at least they look like a project that may have some possibility of succeeding. I don't know what that is. So Tilly, first of all, he starts his thing by pointing out how, because basically is how you transform this inflow of capital that is needed for the U.S. to perform its world imperial functions into a protection payment. And he says protection. The word protection sounds two contrasting tones. One is comforting, the other ominous. With one tone, protection calls up images of the shelter against danger provided by a powerful friend or a sturdy roof. With the other, it evokes the racket in which a local strongman forces merchants to pay tribute in order to avoid damage. Damage the strongman himself threatens to deliver. Which image of the world protection brings to mind depends mainly on our assessment of the reality and externality of the threat. Someone who produces both the danger and, at a price, the shield against it is a racketeer. Someone who provides a needed shield but has little control over the danger's appearance qualifies as a legitimate protector, especially if his price is no higher than his competitors. And in fact, in a sense, we can see this distinction between the racketeer and the legitimate protector as defining what we may call in international worldwide terms hegemony in the second case and domination in the first, in a Gramscian sense. So in this sense, the significance of the events of the last 3 or 4 years is that, in fact, with the collapse of the bubble in 1990 and the subsequent 9/11 attack, and above all with the US reaction to all this, for all practical purposes, and as demonstrated by the reaction against the US war in Iraq, US hegemony has ended. It's over. Now it's coercion pure and simple. But it's a coercion that has not to be seen only in terms of the sort of domination and oppression and exploitation of the weak, has to be seen also in terms of extorting a tribute or an extortion payment from those who can actually pay the payments. It's a question of, therefore, producing simultaneously the insecurity that creates a demand for protection, and at the same time being the monopolist in the supply of the protection. And I think this is probably the best way of conceptualizing the new imperialism that is taking shape these days, and to think about the future and where we are. That much? No.
Actually, it's only 2 minutes.
No, that's what I thought. I thought, okay, I'll take. I can stop anyway. I haven't worked this out. I'm just throwing it there because that's you can probably just work things out yourself. I mean, it's a way of trying to understand what is happening, and also in trying to understand these conflicts that arise, that appears at first sight as possible reemergence of inter-imperialist rivalries. I think that Walden is going to say that, as I said that the other day. I don't agree. I think that it's really, partly we can see that the problem with the Europeans is they want to be part, there are two problems. Some of them, those who have any actual capacity of providing protection, and we should not underestimate the capacities of Britain and France, as opposed to pathetic countries from this point of view, like Italy or Spain. Particularly Italy, but Britain and France, because of the tradition or whatever, they are actually, not just insignificant potential racketeers in this business. And many of the conflicts is that either, in the case of Japan and Germany and so on, it's a question of not having to pay too much in terms of extortion and tribute. Or it's a question of no taxation without representation. In other words, like claims of Japan and Germany for having a seat in the Security Council, etc., is a claim, if we have to pay, we want representation in the organ. In other cases, is like France, we are suppliers too. We can also supply protection, and we are going to show that we can supply protection. So thinking in these terms, I think it's far more helpful than thinking in the old terms of inter-imperialist rivalries. I mean, of course, you can use the same term to call very different things. And this also tells you something about the fact that this strategy is very risky, because of course particularly with modern weaponry and the ease with which it can actually be reproduced, and the monopoly in many ways is less stable than it may seem. There is, of course, the danger of creating more instability and insecurity than you are able to supply sufficient protection. And therefore, the third scenario of that I pointed out in the long 20th century is precisely a situation where, in this particular kind of struggle that is going on, more chaos is created than can actually be brought under control by New World Order, and therefore the whole thing goes up in flames. So it's a very risky thing, but it has its own rationality, which is the rationality of the racketeer on a global scale, which is totally new. Anyway, these are just hypotheses, and I can stop.
Thank you very much, Giovanni.